Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone.
I'm sure you this week are still riding the same Hillary Clinton announcement glow that my daughter is.
It's
I mean,
yeah, at least
is it a
72
stark
hours
moment
of
at all?
afterglow. Yeah.
I'm sure you did just what I did when the video was announced, that you took your kids, you put them on the couch, you hooked up your Chromecast, you got your YouTube on your phone, you threw up the Hillary announcement on the big screen TV and said, "Look, kids, there's a woman running for president for the first time. Isn't that exciting?" That's what you did,
Well, not the first time she's running for
right?
president, but no, but it is history. I mean, look, you tend to be cynical. We follow this all the time, but I guess it's the anniversary of Lincoln's assassination, and there's this picture supposedly of Teddy Roosevelt, or this story that Theodore Roosevelt looked out his window as Lincoln's procession went by. You've got the famous picture of Bill Clinton shaking hands with John F. Kennedy. I mean, some of the people that we are covering right now, we don't know what history, what the future will hold, and that they may, in fact, go down in history. And your kids, it's kind of cool that they could be, at least watching something noteworthy like this.
I mean, my sole motivation, this, I gotta say, as a general matter, obviously they see me on my computer a lot. They see me looking at political things. They ask me, "Who is this? Who is that?" And I'll tell them who they are. So I can't pretend that I'm not involved in politics as part of my profession. But I do not get into my partisan beliefs or ideological philosophy or anything like that. I want to keep everything very close to the vest. I don't want to give him any opening to rebel on me and be and take the opposite view of me just to stick it to me, because that's what they're going to do
Oh, well,
if
that
they know too
happens.
much.
Yeah, there's a great Family Ties episode where Alex P. Keaton's dating this girl,
Oh yeah. Classic
and
episode.
yeah, is it she's against the ERA or she's for the
Either she's
ERA?
for the ERA, and he pretends to be for the ERA and gets thrown in prison to impress her.
And then Michael Keaton, the father, not Michael Keaton, what was his name? Michael Gross, but what
Sorry,
was his name?
Stephen Keaton.
Stephen Keaton, recalls a story where he once dated a Goldwater gal or a Nixon volunteer
It was
because,
Nixon. It was Nixon.
yeah, even though he's like this bleeding heart liberal, hippie, he dated
Right, right.
this hot Nixon girl. Her that girl's name turned out to be Hillary Clinton. That's the funny part of the story they didn't get to. But anyway, that happens, so be careful about the rebellion. I think you're wise to
I'm
be
very
on
careful
guard.
about that, but I've been generally annoyed that when I talk about presidents with her, and we got a couple presidents' books in the house, it's annoying that they're all men. I'm implicitly sending her this terrible message that there's something that she has not had access to. So I was eager just to be able to say, partisan affiliation aside, look, there is a woman running for president. Look at that. I
Right.
didn't, lay it on thick. I just wanted to show her that that was happening, and just so it's there. And interestingly, as soon as I showed her the video, my oldest one, turns to me and says, "Are you gonna vote for her?" And I said, "Oh, well, maybe, but I gotta see who else is running." And she was like, "You should vote for her. I'm for Hillary." I was like, "Okay, I guess we're done here." My 3-year-old was less impressed. She was a little more distracted, but
Well,
my indoctrination might have implicitly worked.
it is interesting. We didn't know if we were going to have boys or girls, and if we'd had two girls instead of two boys, I think the whole dynamic of my family would be different. I'd probably be different today. My political views might even be different. I might even be more conservative. I think there was this study that shows that we're sort of the opposite, I guess, of that. But when we thought, we could have girls, my wife is a very tough, strong woman, you know her, Bill, and a very accomplished professional in her own right. And we thought, like, how do we expose her to we want her to be, you know, to want to be president or something. Not that we would be like overly ambitious or pushy, but like in a world where the culture is selling you maybe like Britney Spears or Miley Cyrus, how do you encourage something else? And I started learning about like Benazir Bhutto, who, you know, she wasn't even the oldest. She had an older brother, but she became her father's heir. You know, she went with him to meetings and became his heir apparent, even though she had an older brother, at least as I recall when I watched this documentary. I think it's called Bhutto. Now, it turns out, you know, we thought about like what to name the daughter, and my wife thought it was very important we name our children after like really important and good people. And so we thought Thatcher, but like Thatcher's maybe not a great first name. Bhutto,
Thatch is a great nickname.
What's that?
Thatch is a great nickname.
Thatcher?
See, Thatch. I mean, Thatch is a good nickname.
I'm picturing a fat chick with the Thatcher first name. I don't know why. I can't get past it. No offense if you're named Thatcher, because I'm a fan of Thatcher. But Bhutto, you know, it turns out Benazir Bhutto, even though I guess she's now somewhat of a martyr, sort of a mixed legacy, you know? Not necessarily a heroic figure. And so anyway, that is something we looked into, and I think it is incumbent upon you, Bill, and obviously you're doing a good job here, to expose your daughters to, you know, successful women. And I can imagine that having a female president, maybe that's going to be President, you know, Susana Martinez or something, but someday when that happens, Bill, that's going to be a good message to say.
Your backhanded dismissal of Carly Fiorina, I find very disappointing.
Carly is going to be in the cabinet, Bill. Not president, but she'll be in the cabinet.
Department of layoffs? Is that the plan?
I should say, Bill, in all. Right now, we've had three people announced, and on the Republican side. And when Rubio was giving his announcement, and my oldest son was watching a little bit of it with me, I was thinking, you know, who knows? Maybe Rubio goes on to be, you know, a Reagan-esque, Kennedy-esque, whatever-esque figure in history, and my son will have watched. I mean, it's not like he's there, but he will have watched on C-SPAN the announcement speech.
They're at the beginning.
And that's kind of cool, you know? That's kind of cool. So, you know, even though we try to be jaded, well, we don't try to be. We become jaded. We become cynical. I actually try to keep the separation from the politicians, you know? They're and this feeds into our segue here, but there are journalists who want access. And sometimes it's helpful, clearly, to talk to these folks, but I like to keep them at a bit of a distance so I can feel free to criticize them and attack them and not let any sentimentality or affinity enter into that. So there.
Well, let me bring us back to Hillary, because I'm curious your thoughts on not just the video, but the entire rollout. We've had Republican rollouts. We've had Cruz and Rand, and now Rubio and Hillary. I mean, each of these rollouts has been very, very different. And the Hillary one has been the most associated with actual campaigning. Although it's someone unorthodox campaigning, but you know, Rand followed a bunch of interviews, contentious interviews, and some speeches. Cruz, I think, just did a little bit of interviewing, and I haven't heard much from him since. And Rubio had to go back to the Senate, you know, cast a vote on the Corker Iran bill yesterday. But the Clinton thing, you know, the swarm of media dissecting every little minuscule move that she is doing. I feel like I read completely diametrically opposite takes on how good or bad the rollout is. What's your thought on how it's going so far?
Well, I mean, I'm just going to play it a type here, Bill. I really think it's not very good. I think that everything great about Hillary exists in our imagination, and when she actually does stuff, it just rarely is that good. And I feel the same way about her I kind of feel about Scott Walker, that there's something that's going to fall apart about them, that they're both, and you know, obviously Hillary has a much clearer path to the nomination on the Democratic side than does Walker, but both are doing very well right now. But I have a feeling of impending doom about something about them that I just don't think is going to work. And
put that aside for a second. Let's look at what has actually transpired. She has a set video piece that communicates the messages she wants to communicate. At minimum, garners a lot of press coverage for what she is doing. So she is dominating the news space. When she gets to Iowa, she has her little roundtables and whatnot. She gets local news headlines ticking off what her main messages were there. She has four ways she wants to be a champion for everyday Americans. She wants to talking about family and jobs and foreign policy and money in politics, obviously people are second guessing this and that about stopping at Chipotle and not having enough policy detail and all that kind of stuff. But compared to say what Rand Paul went through with his tangles with interviewers, or Ted Cruz kind of falling off the radar after the initial announcement, isn't there something to be said of as far as these things go, you own the media space, you've got your messages out, people are going to say what they're going to say, but that's the best one can do in the first years. Isn't that not terrible execution?
Well, first of all, you know, comparing her to Rand Paul is not a great thing for Hillary. I mean, she's got this clear path. She's got so many advantages, and I think Rand is a flawed candidate. If that's sort of if that's the bar she needs to hit, then I think she's in trouble. I really, really hate to sound predictable. I really prefer to be a contrarian, but I just have to tell you, it's just not good. Bill, she doesn't. She seems like yesterday. I mean.
That seems like a broader critique about her as a candidate, which
you can't make her. It's just, she's a flawed product. It just, and even her messaging, I mean, the populism stuff is borrowed from Elizabeth Warren. We're talking about the Clintons, who've raised more money than anybody, who rented out the Lincoln bedroom. The idea that they're going to clean up government or get money out of it, it's just, it seems implausible. And she just looks and feels like yesterday. And so the execution, the whether or not she like leaps this hurdle or it's almost beside the point. She as a symbol is, I don't think people are going to buy it. I mean, the only thing she has going for her, I think, is the big history thing, which is huge. Is that enough? I don't know.
But do you? I get that you feel that she's sort of rotten to the core. But could you objectively say, I think she should have had this sort of rollout instead of that sort of rollout? This, if she did it differently like this, that would have fit the kind of candidate that she is. Or you just think that there's no way to salvage this, that she's dead on arrival.
Well, look, I mean, I think she might win just by virtue of the history thing and by, you know, just be. For all the various factors, electorally, it's very hard for Republicans to win. They've lost five. Republicans have lost five out of the last six popular votes, Bill. And she's got nobody running against her on the Democratic Party. So I think she, you know, she may win despite being a very flawed candidate. Could she have done anything better? I don't know. Now, when I look at her problem last time, the problem was the inevitability thing. And there's also the potential problem that people see her as kind of old. And to me, the way to overcome that would have been, rather than having the video, which seems inert and I don't know. I would have had her on the stump, giving and not like snuck in the back room of some school door, speaking to a small group of people. I mean, have her. I would have had the launch be her stumping, fighting for votes, asking for votes, showing, not telling, but showing that she's vigorous and has energy and is taking this seriously, does not see herself as inevitable, not sitting, drinking coffee, talking to a handful of people with who may or may not have pre-selected questions. But here's the problem with that, Bill. I don't think she could do that. Like, I don't think she has it in her to do that. So therefore, I think you have to do the video, and you have to. So I think they probably, given the candidate that they have, they probably did the best rollout they could. But compare it to Marco Rubio's speech. I mean, it's that you want to talk about a contrast. I mean, and he nailed it. You know, she did him the best favor in the world by announcing before him. There was this fear that she would overshadow him. Instead, she gave him the raison d'etre, or whatever that word is. He was in his speech, the yesterday's gone, Fleetwood Mac thing. And I hate to be predictable, but I'm going to have to be here.
Well, I agree with, I think, a little bit of what you're saying in that, I feel like this rollout was more suited to the kind of candidate that she is. She's not fantastic on the stump. I mean, she's fine. She's a fine speaker, but she's not a dazzling speaker. She did some set speeches before the announcement, and people thought they were kind of boring. I mean, she's a bit of a wonky candidate. So why force her into something that's sort of outside of her element? You know, she's at her most natural at a policy roundtable. That's kind of her. You know, Jeb Bush also very sort. Jeb Bush, we've seen, not so great reading from prepared remarks, much better doing conversational Q&A. So once you know that about your guy,
right?
You know,
I agree with you, Bill. But the problem with that is that when you play to her strength, or rather, more precisely, when you avoid her weakness, you are also reinforcing another narrative about her, about the secrecy, about how she's guarded, how she's separate from the people. And so I think that there are like real structural like problems that she has as a candidate. And I don't
know. A policy discussion with Iowans? I mean, obviously, you can criticize her for being, you know, semi-stage or pre-screen questions or what have you. Obviously, people are going to make those, but all candidates do that sort of stuff all the time. I mean, the local coverage in Iowa is, here's Hillary Clinton talking to locals about policy. I mean, how is that somehow going to be off-putting to people?
And maybe some of it's the optics, Bill. This did not look to me like someone sitting in a coffee shop where anybody could have just sort of shown up and heard. It seemed like you had to kind of know somebody to get into that event. Like, it was a ticketed event, and it felt elitist to me. Now, that was me watching it on TV, but that's how most Americans are consuming it. I'm not worried about Iowa. I mean, it is, you know, eventually going to be important to the general election, but it's not like she has to win the Iowa caucuses this time.
I mean, is every Republican event out there going to be open to the public, no tickets, and everyone come in and heckle me at will? No, everyone has invite-only events on the trail.
This is her rollout, and she has stereotypes and narratives that she has to overcome and challenge, and this reinforces the negative ones. It doesn't overcome them. I mean, I hate to play the type here, man, and I'm willing to believe that maybe some of it's a Rorschach test, but it just, compare her to Obama, compare her to Bill Clinton, she does not have it. And
so now what do you think about the press coverage? I mean, I feel there's sort of two memes that I've seen. One is that the media has gone hyper negative on her. How dare she go into a Chipotle and not shake everybody's hand? Bill Clinton would have shook everybody's hand till the last dog died. She's the worst candidate ever.
He would have.
And then the next day, the media is chasing her across the field, and the media is a bunch of pathetic lapdogs trying to, you know, suck up to Hillary, and Hillary's leading him by the nose. So, you know, which is it? Is the media in the tank for Hillary, or is the media going to nitpick Hillary to death?
I'll answer both questions quickly and then move to my larger point. Number one, I think she should have gone in and shaken hands. If you want to get, look, if you're running a county commissioner race in Frederick, Maryland, and you go to Roy Rogers and you don't go around and shake everybody's hand, you're not a good candidate. This is the pros. And you know, Hillary was wearing like sunglasses, it seemed like, and she doesn't really, she's incognito, doesn't necessarily want to talk to people. That was a bad move. Are the press in the tank for Hillary? I think it's the opposite. I think she's in trouble. I think that this attention's bad for her. I think that they're actually being very critical of her and skeptical of her, quite unlike their fawning coverage of Obama. I think that she's got a real problem. They liked Obama. They like, but there's a narrative about Hillary that is not good, and I do not think the media is doing her any favors. What they are, though, doing is embarrassing themselves. And I know everybody saw that video that outlets have put out, you know, where you see this guy in red pants in the press. I guess Alex Seitz-Wald from MSNBC is doing a stand-up with Thomas Roberts, and in the background, you see the press scrum. They see the mystery machine, you know, the Scooby van or whatever that Hillary's riding around in, and they go like little children on Christmas morning running after Hillary. Now, I don't think that's because they're fawning after Hillary. They did the same sort of thing when Sarah Palin led them on a wild goose bus chase in like 2011 or whatever. This is indicative of people wanting to get the scoop. And that's where I want to have a little bit of a conversation, Bill, because when I saw those reporters running after her, it's pathetic. And on one hand, I had these competing thoughts. The first thought was, is this what you want your career to be about? Did you get involved in journalism? Whether those are local or national reporters, or both, did you get involved in journalism because you want to run and chase after politicians and look pathetic? But the other thought I had was, there but for the grace of God go I. Like, what if that was my, this, like, you know, there's like a line in Bull Durham where Susan Sarandon says, you know, baseball's a game, but it's also a job, right? Well, journalism is fun and artistic, but it's also a job. And what if you're a cup reporter and your job is to get that picture of Hillary, God forbid, walking in the back door of that school or whatever, or ask her some question? You run, right? That's what you get paid for. So are we being too harsh on the media, or, you know, what's up with that, Bill Scher?
Well, I mean, I you know, when I was in college, I did an internship at a local TV station, and I was on stakeouts. When usually you're staking out a place where you know a news subject's going to be, and you sit there for 3 hours and you wait for that person to come, so you get 5 seconds of video and you bring it back to the TV station. That is your job. Your job is to get that shot. Otherwise, the local news that night doesn't have video for that news segment. I mean, that's just sort of the nuts and bolts of the business. Typically, you kind of know where the action's going to be, and you stake out your spot. This happened to be a case where, you know, the Clintons were being a little cagey about where the entrance was going to be, because they're trying to do very tiny events in this initial run. And I think it's also probably why she didn't shake hands in the Chipotle, because the point was to have the first campaign appearance be in Iowa, where the first caucus is. You don't give that to Ohio, you give it to Iowa. And part of doing the van trip means you got to get off the road some point and get a bite to eat. So they wanted to do that and not have it be a campaign appearance.
I think it would have been, sorry to interrupt, let me just jump in real quick and then I'll jump out. I think it would have been great publicity and quite a build-up, sort of a drumbeat of excitement. If number one, Ohio is a pretty important state. It's the swing state, arguably. Hillary going to the Chipotle and shaking hands with people, going behind the counter, talking to people, washing dishes. I think that builds the excitement and makes her more compelling when she gets to Iowa.
I mean, I don't think you're wrong. I just don't think it's the make or break decision of the campaign. They had a game plan in mind. They executed it. And so what you have in Iowa is a situation where she's not looking to do a media scrum before the roundtable, so she doesn't give the media a spot to sit so they can have that, and so they end up being in the wrong spot, and then they have to go run to be in the right spot. I mean, that's just sort of the way the business works sometimes. I don't think there is a larger meta point about that. What's different is that perhaps the average person is seeing what that what that on the ground job is like sometimes.
Yeah.
But well, it looks like that sometimes.
It looked really humiliating and embarrassing. And let me just say, if that was my job, then here's my take, and this is going to sound elitist, but so be it. If that's what my job came down to, I think I might as well, like, I'd just go work at a factory and make widgets or something. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, what good, you know?
When you have that job, you are not in a factory making widgets. You're not stuck behind a cubicle in a cube farm. You're actually outside watching, you know, history being made. People find that fun. That's their worse jobs to have than, you know, running around with a camera out in the outdoors, you know, taking shots of people.
Well,
there's an adrenaline rush that goes with that.
I mean, I see both sides. Like, when it is your job to get that footage or to ask that question, then you do what you run, you hustle. So I don't see it, I didn't see it as them fawning over Hillary or treating her like some, you know, I sort of did joke on Twitter, you know, if I can but touch the hem of her garment, you know, but I really don't see it as like an example of liberal bias because, like I said, they chased Sarah Palin on a silly goose, wild goose chase a few years ago. And you could argue that the coverage was going to be more hostile toward Palin. But again, I think the coverage has been pretty rough toward Hillary so far, too. It hasn't, in my opinion, before. So I don't see it. I don't see this as like a, there's the liberal media sucking up to Hillary. I see it as like, it looks really pathetic. But you know, but maybe, I'm guessing a lot of people who work hard for the money, who earn a paycheck, do a lot of pathetic things, and usually the things that we do behind the scenes, the sausage making, isn't necessarily, you know, broadcast on TV and turned into a meme with silly music put behind it. I mean, you know, and kudos to the guy wearing the Nantucket Reds, because way to stand out on camera with those pants, Broza. Good job there.
Now, I don't want to spend the whole time on Hillary, so I'll just say briefly, I have a piece up at Politico about how the real Democratic race is the race to win Hillary as opposed to Hillary winning the race because she's going to be the nominee. But there are various factions in the party, the establishment, the populace trying to win her platform. So I have a dissertation on that over at Politico today. But I want to shift to your side of the aisle because you had this week not only the Rubio announcement. You also have Chris Christie putting his toe back in the water with this town hall in New Hampshire. But just to pick up where your last thread was, you were very impressed with the Rubio rollout. You think he's not been overshadowed by Hillary going the day after her. But do you think this is sustainable for him? I agree he had a good day and made a nice speech, but he strikes me as being handicapped by not having an obvious issue that is his. He doesn't have a long record. He's still a first-term senator. You can say, well, so was Obama, but Obama had the Iraq War to wave around and say, I had the judgment where all these big shots in my party didn't. He didn't seem to have that. So even if you can give a nice speech and he's got a nice bio, what's step two to build on that and actually consolidate a good chunk of support where we can actually take on Jeb mano a mano?
So first of all, I mean, I think that the speech, the announcement was not just a home run, but a grand slam. It was, you know, first of all, as I said earlier, I think Hillary's announcement the day earlier actually set up him perfectly. Rather than overshadow him, it actually, he should send her a thank you note. It set up an entire rationale for his candidacy and a stark contrast. A bridge to the past, Hillary, versus a bridge to the future, passing the torch to the next generation, all that good stuff. I think that Ted Cruz and Rand Paul had applause lines. Rubio had a rationale, a narrative that he embodies. He symbolizes this generational thing. And so I think that the announcement and the speech are terrific. I share your concern that he cannot sustain it. And I think part of the problem is that the speech he gave in the announcement is visionary, it's symbolic, it's you're challenging us to our better angels, it's poetic, it's all of these things about politics that are poetry, not prose. And then he goes back to the Senate, where he's not a backbencher, I mean, in the sense that he's actually very active. And he goes back to the Senate, and he gets back in the mud, because he has to, because that's where, you know, the sausage making, or what, how, whatever the analogy we want to use. Now he's back in the land of the carnal land of mortals. He was in the heavens. Now he's down voting on things, talking, you know, arguing about things that are, in some cases, I don't want to say petty, but, you know, it gets him away from the grand visionary stuff that he does well. So it was sort of the way Obama did. And I think, in a way, he can't do this because he's a first-term senator. But in a way, if Rubio had a couple of terms under his belt, or if he would be better off to leave the Senate today and to go on a barnstorming tour around the country, giving speeches, talking about big ideas, and separating himself from the minutiae, from the quotidian BS. And I think he performs better when he's talking about the big ideas and the vision stuff. What was it that George H.W. Bush called it? The vision thing. That's where he thrives, but he can't stay there. He can't stay there because he has to be among the mortals now in the Senate, which, yes, I know it's the most exclusive club, but, you know, he's going to have to be talking about issues that are controversial. You know, what do we do?
I think there are a lot of things around the corner which are going to be very unpleasant for. I mean, look, you got four senators running. You have Rubio, you have Cruz, you have Paul, and Lindsey Graham is not formally announced yet. So, Cruz and Paul are.
I'm sorry, but you're probably going to say this. I think Cruz and Paul, they're fine being in these fights. That's their bread and butter, right? It's fighting. Let's, you know, get rid of the IRS or whatever. I mean,
right.
But I think Rubio performs best when he's elevated above the fray, not down in the muck and mire.
Well, even worse, I mean, you have situations where Cruz and Paul are going to do some big-time grandstanding on the floor and taking positions that might make Rubio more uncomfortable, and he has to figure out, do I, you know, take a roundhouse to Cruz and Paul here and show that I'm not going to be, you know, dragged them off a cliff, or does he have to side with them and then lose any kind of way to distinguish himself because he's leading, he's following and not leading. And so you got stuff down the pike, like,
and that happened,
you reauthorize
before.
That happened before.
That happened before, Bill. And that was, I think, maybe Rubio's lowest point was after the pushback on immigration reform,
right,
when he joins in with the effort to defund Obamacare and thus shut down the government. Now, all of a sudden, Rubio's a follower, not a leader. And I don't think that's going to happen again, but it's happened before.
But for it to not happen, I mean, with immigration, I mean, I said this, I was on MSNBC the other day, and I was very dismissive about Rubio's chances. I mean, you know, he set himself up as to be the leader in immigration. He sticks his neck out on the Senate bill to support it. And then when the heat comes on, he folds and says, this bill is no good and the House should do things its own way, and just made everybody mad in the process. So the only way for him to lead in a way that's not the way Cruz and Paul are leading, you know, for some of these things, not across the board.
I have to say, I think this narrative has stuck, but I disagree with it. Like, I think you're on the right side of, I think your perception is conventional wisdom now. But the idea that Rubio championed a bill, voted for it, and it passed the U.S. Senate for immigration reform. Like, he did something that Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton haven't done. He championed this bill, I think, rather courageously, and voted for it, and it passed the Senate. Then it didn't pass the House. I think it is now entirely reasonable for him.
But he talked it down after it passed and made it harder for it to pass the House. He didn't stick with the bill and help drive it all the way through.
I think it's now entirely reasonable for him to say, because let me just say, if you listen to his announcement speech, he says in his announcement speech, we need to fix immigration reform. So he brought it up in his speech. Now, what that means is in the eye of the beholder. He didn't get into specifics, but he brought up fixing immigration reform in his announcement speech, I think, what, on Monday or whatever. So anyway, I don't want to get you know, bogged down on this issue, but I don't see the immigration experience, reform experience, as an example of anything but a profile in courage. But I know
Becomes how do the future Senate fights, do they fit that narrative or do they undermine that narrative? You know, if he's not going to be as belligerent as Cruz and Paul on, say, keeping the government open in September or lifting the debt ceiling in October, or even before then, the highway trust fund gets reauthorized probably towards the end of summer. You know, these are things that, you know, Tea Party folks are going to say you should be voting against this stuff, and establishment folks are going to be saying that's political suicide. So he's going to have a tricky time dancing with Cruz and Paul on those subjects. Now, more imminently, he may be able to take a leadership role in the Iran Corker bill, which just cleared. He voted for it in committee, as everybody else. It was unanimous in the committee. So folks know what is going on here. This was a bipartisan bill. It was partially negotiated with the White House. The White House successfully watered it down in some key areas. For example, they took out a provision that said Iran, that the White House would have to report to the Congress that Iran was not sponsoring terrorist activities against Israel to maintain the terms of the deal. Now, that goes outside of what the preliminary agreement currently says. This is the negotiations meant to be about the nuclear program only, and not into the other issues that we have with Iran. For example, we have sanctions on Iran that are terrorist related that would not be lifted under the terms of the nuclear deal. But Rubio, in voting for the Corker bill, which the White House has acceded to because it won't strip the White House's ability to have a sanctions waiver at the beginning of the deal that essentially gives the deal its initial push, and that's what the White House really wanted to protect, and they won that. Rubio is talking about possibly putting an amendment on the Senate floor, the full Senate floor, to put in a pro-Israel provision on the floor, which would, in all likelihood, you know, move Democrats away, risk a White House veto, and make it not the unanimous product that it currently was. So from Rubio's perspective, if he leads on that subject, if he sinks the bill, he's leading, he's fighting, he's on the high road, and he's fighting the good fight from what the folks on the conservative base want him to do. Does he want to be, does he want to take the risk of essentially killing the Corker bill and having Congress then have no indirect say on what the terms of the Iran deal is? So I'm curious how he chooses to play this in the next couple of weeks.
Well, and therein lies the problem. He'd be better off if he wasn't in the Senate, or if he was a governor, or if he didn't have to do these things. And you could also argue that some of these things undermine his brand, which is, you know, right now contrasted with Hillary about forward thinking tomorrow, right? So the brand isn't just young versus old. It's about young ideas versus old ideas, young fights, young battles versus, old fights, old battles versus the future. But quite often Rubio is finding himself bogged down fighting old battles, right? And so it muddies that message a little bit. I think yesterday Jake Tapper said something to him about you're on the old side of history on gay marriage or something like that. I mean, some of this might be inevitable, but remember how Barack Obama, you know, accused Mitt Romney of being stuck in the 1980s because he saw Russia as a geopolitical foe. A similar sort of attack could sort of undermine Rubio's argument that he's the future, he's the generational change. You'd certainly argue he's stuck in a Cold War mindset, a Cold War paradigm, and that he might be young physically, but he's got these same old tired Republican ideas. And the fact that he's in the Senate taking these votes makes him more susceptible to that charge.
But I will say this for Rubio. He is the one candidate that has actually formulated some new policy ideas. I mean, I'm not personally impressed with the ideas, but they are at least new ideas. Ways he wants to rejigger poverty programs and shift money around, and say he would argue they'd make them more efficient and more potent. I would argue he's just sort of rearranging the deck chairs, but at least it's something. It's more than anyone else has done on the Republican side right now. Although now you have Chris Christie coming in, who is not formally announced yet. There was talk in the New York Times this week that indictments in Bridgegate might be forthcoming and might actually ensnare people that are very close to him. Nevertheless, he goes to New Hampshire, he does town halls, and he does a big speech where he puts a very specific Social Security reform proposal on the table, means testing above $200,000 a year, raising the retirement age, you know, effectively Social Security cuts, in a way more specific than what a lot of Republicans have been willing to do since the George Bush privatization effort fell apart. So if Christie runs and does this, what kind of pressure does that put on the other candidates? You have to match him on Social Security and possibly make your general election prospects a little dicier, because if you don't, because most of the conservative base feels like this is a serious problem, it's an imminent crisis, and we got to be big boys and girls and solve it. If Chris is the only one doing that, and you're not, then you're not leading anymore, right? So how do Republicans get out of this vice?
Well, I mean, talk about a profile in courage. I mean, I think tackling entitlement reform is something we absolutely have to do, and also something that I think is incredibly politically toxic. At least I still believe that, and maybe it's because I'm a little older than some of the folks that I work with who see it differently. But it is funny, we put up on the Daily Caller's Facebook page something about this yesterday, and several comments were people who are ostensibly conservative saying something to the effect of, get government out of my Social Security. they were saying, I've been paying into this for 45 years and you can't take it away from me. And these are people who are ostensibly conservatives. Apparently not aware of the fact that it would be sort of implemented slowly, that they would probably be grandfathered in. Probably apparently not aware of the fact that it's a Ponzi scheme, that the notion that like the money I'm putting in my lockbox is going to actually be there for me. But anyway, I mean, if we're having that kind of pushback at the Daily Caller, how's this going to play in Peoria? So I think that Christie is right on the issue, but I think it's very dangerous politically. Now, I think he's throwing a Hail Mary. He may feel like he's got nothing to lose. He needs to shake things up, and that the odds, you know, he needs to like go big or go home. But I think you're exactly right, Bill. If he catches on and if this catches fire, it puts Republicans then in a position where it's very relevant and legitimate for George Stephanopoulos or whomever to ask them pointed questions about this. And then you see ads about grannies being, you know, pushed off cliffs in wheelchairs. The interesting thing is, you know, Paul Ryan, of course, has been championing entitlement reform for years. And I thought that it would be a real detriment and that it would be used against the Republican ticket last time around when he was the running mate. And it really wasn't that much. So maybe I'm operating in a bygone era of the third rail of politics. I'm not sure, but it strikes me as very good policy and very dangerous politics.
I mean, we only got a couple minutes left here, but I mean, how do you, can you, are you able to kind of game out what this means for the Republican primary dynamic? Is everybody going to have their one issue that pushes the envelope, and therefore it's a sort of this cacophony of ideas that doesn't force everybody to adopt the same idea, and therefore maybe a Jeb Bush can beg off of all of them and keep his options open, or is everyone going to have to embrace all the same ideas and then you're dragged so far to the right then in the specifics that you're easy pickings come November? I mean, is there a middle ground here for Republicans to navigate this minefield of politically toxic positioning?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there is. I mean, look, you can start with means testing. I think that's an obvious place to start. It has a populist appeal. Why should rich people, why should millionaires get Social Security? That's something that should resonate. The only people who aren't in favor of that are sort of strategic thinking partisan liberals. But I think it has wide, broad-based appeal.
There might be some upper middle class Republican suburbanites that might disagree.
They might disagree on principle, but how motivated are they going to be to fight over it? I mean, are they really going to get to check? Did we get that $250 Social Security check today or not? Because they're millionaires. I mean,
many of us have asked, why do they care about the estate tax? Why do they care about top end tax cuts? It's not that much money for them, but they seem to really care about that last bit of money all the time.
I will say this. I think that it's that at the end of the day, it's not isolated issues. I mean, we do associate some candidates with issues, McCain with campaign finance reform, Steve Forbes with the flat tax. But guess what? They didn't win when they were stressing those issues. I think it's really, we vote for people, for brands, for people, for what we think of them, not for any special issue. And along those lines, I think that's where Rubio right now has the leg up. Everything about his speech and his rollout was about casting him as the change agent, not about any one idea. It's about a broadish ideas about the American dream and about passing the torch to a new generation. I think that's why Rubio at this point has won the rollout war. But can he keep it up? That is going to be a big if.
Well, I'm going to leave it there because I got to jump, but it's always good to talk to you. I'll be off next week, so I'm not sure if we're going to do a show. If you're going to get a sub, we'll have to work that out. But I'll see you in 2 weeks.
All right. Have a good one, and thank you all for watching, and we'll see you very soon.
Thanks. Take care.